message like this. There are moments that I told you in Colossians so far where it's almost difficult to distinguish between Paul's teaching and Paul's praying. This is one where it feels as though Paul has pulled back from just regular rhythms of teaching and said, listen, hear this, feel this, sing this with me. Commentators will argue, probably for another couple centuries, about whether or not Paul wrote this, whether he's quoting something that's there, whether this is a true song, whether it's a confession. Whatever it is, it's memorable. It has a rhythm. It has a pace. It has maybe not quite rhyme to it, but it sings well, doesn't it? We'll take the song and also just put it into the email so that you can find your way through it. And if you want to listen again, there's a number of things that artist Andrew Peterson does that I think are particularly well done. We often borrow from a lot of his stuff over Easter weekend because of some of his work. This passage, though, is not just poetic in the sense that you might think of some poems where the point is on the rhyme or the point is somehow kind of built into the rhythm or the structure. There's some dense language in this as well. In fact, reading through Colossians 1, 15 to 20 reminds me of a time when I was talking to a past member early in my time here. His name was Aaron Radke. He is now Dr. Aaron Radke. And this was before he was a doctor. He was putting together his dissertation. And I was asking him a little bit. You know, and now Aaron was a legit rocket scientist. This is kind of the work that he did. And this was, there were elements of things like this. And I said, well, Aaron, I don't quite understand exactly what you're getting your doctorate in. And he said, it's okay, then not a lot of people do. And I said, well, could I read your dissertation? And he's like, I mean, if you wanted to try. I'm like, I speak English, man, come on. Like, let's not be so patronizing. Could I at least read your abstract? He's like, well, sure. Here's what he gave me. This paper gives a unified and historical review of observer design for the benefit of practitioners. It is unified in the sense that all observers are examined in terms of the assumed dynamic structures of the plant, point one, the required information, including the input signals and modeling information of the plant, point two, and the implementation equation of the observer, point three. This allows a practitioner with a particular observer design problem in mind to find a suitable solution. The review is historical in the sense that it follows the evolution of designs and observer design in the last half century, from the distinction in problem formulation, required modeling information, and the observer design goal, we can see two. You're wondering how much longer? I have only a couple more lines. We can see two schools of thought. One is developed in the framework of a modern control theory. The other is based in disturbance estimation, which has been, to some extent, overlooked. And that's exactly the point that I would make if I was really trying to talk with someone about this. There's not a single word in this I didn't understand. But I have absolutely no idea what his dissertation's about. I know what an estimation is. I know what control is. I know what an observer and design and implementation are. There wasn't a single word in that that didn't make sense to me. But I had no idea how he was using them. And I'm afraid that that's perhaps the way that we come to some passages of Scripture. Particularly one like this. And so as we've done in the past couple texts that we've looked at, what we want to do is we're going to read it through. And we're going to pause in the beginning on the nouns. We're just going to try and make some comments about the nouns. And then we're going to come back and do a little bit more grammatical work. But the two points that you have in your bulletin are really based on prepositional phrases, not so much the nouns. So let's get the nouns out of the way, try to see if we can figure them out. And then we're really going to soak in and sing and reflect on how absolutely inimitable Jesus is in this passage. And in fact, I'm going to give away the application point. It's not to do anything. It's not to imitate anything. It's to worship the only one who can make these claims in this passage. So let's look at the nouns. We start here in verse 15. He is the image of the invisible God and the firstborn of creation. Those are the first two nouns that really dominate. The rest that we get in 16 is other stuff that we kind of know, But the one noun that really focuses on Jesus has to do with this concept of image. It's a similar word to likeness. And in case you're wondering about my mastery of the Greek, just like I would have needed Aaron's help in order to understand his thesis, Michael Gregory and I sat down this week. We had a Zoom call where I just had to say, Michael, you're going to have to help me a little bit with this one because I'm curious, how does this function or how does that work? Does this mean this? And it was really helpful. Am I going to reflect everything that Michael relayed to me? Absolutely not. But I hope that he gave me some boundaries to stay in. One of the things that we talked about, though, is how this word image, we might think of it as a perfect reflection that we see in the mirror, and that's probably not as helpful. Image, there are mirrors in Scripture, to be sure, but this kind of imagery is maybe more what we would think of as an image that a statue is made of, or the image that would be on a coin, a likeness that is on some levels observable, but also that is pointed to a far greater reality than you would get. The statue represents a person that is more than the statue, but it is the statue. The coin has a picture that gives you an idea of who minted the coin and whose authority is over the entire process. And there's a certain sense that if you met Jesus Christ, the man, you might be tempted to reduce him to just what you see in front of you. And Paul is saying, no, no, no. He's an image of an invisible God. He's the one you see, but he represents the one that you don't see. He's also a firstborn over all creation. This is a word that's used two different times. Here, we see that he is the one who is firstborn over all creation, which is giving us an indication of where verse 16 is going to go. To be able to play it out a little bit, he says it's by him that all things were created. And then he basically just puts his arms around everything that you think could be outside the scope of somebody being able to create it. All of the earth. He's not a regional deity. He doesn't have localized power. He is not like one of the Roman deities. He is the one who's created all of the earth. And then gaze out into the heavens as far as you want. Anything that you can see, he made that as well. Or if that's not the way that you would be tempted to limit his power, maybe you would limit it more by his authority over the powers that are existing on the planet, right? So it's visible and invisible, thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities or kings or powers. Anyone who you can see and feel their influence and their control over your life, he's in charge of all that. Everything that you can't see, he's in charge of that. Anywhere you could go, anything you can sense, all of that was created by him. And in that sense, he's the firstborn over creation. Now, if you just took the combined words of first and born, you might be tempted to think that Jesus is then the first person who was made. Obviously, if you know Genesis 1, where there are plenty of echoes of Genesis 1 in this text as well, you recognize Jesus isn't the first person who was made. And he's not just the first thing that was made. There's plenty in other texts to give us the indication Jesus actually was not created. The word firstborn is one that we need a little bit of help on, because if you think of it just as sort of eldest, or if you think of it in terms of birth order categories that we might think about, how does one sibling relate to another? Oh, the firstborn, the first one who was born. In Scripture, often firstborn gives us more inheritance language. The rights over something kind of language. Jacob and Esau could come to mind, right? It's both the prayer that was supposed to belong to Esau that was stolen by Jacob, the blessing that his father would give him, but also the right at Jacob or at Isaac's passing for Esau to get 2/3 of everything that Isaac owned. He gave that right up and gave it to Jacob. If you remember that story, it's firstborn status that's really at play there. In fact, oddly enough, all throughout the Old Testament, You see the one who's the firstborn actually not living up to their firstborn status. And then God chooses another who will displace that firstborn. The search of the Old Testament is looking for a worthy firstborn son. And what Paul is saying is, it's in Jesus that we actually have one. He is the one with the authority over everything that God has made. And he plays that out right there in verse 16. Those are the first couple nouns that we see. They translate into the end of verse 16 and into 17, though. So we get a little bit more of what an idea of what it means for him to be the firstborn. It's not only that he was the agent in making everything. It's that everything was created both through him and for him. And then he's before all things, and now in him all things hold together. We'll come back to those verses, but look at some more nouns that show up then in verse 18. Shifting from what Jesus was doing at creation to how Jesus is involved in our lives, we read this. He's the head of the body. That noun shouldn't really take a whole lot of, you know, explaining. We kind of know what bodies are without heads. They're corpses. But bodies with heads make a lot of sense, right? Those are the kind of bodies that I like relating to. So head doesn't really need a lot of work there. The body is identified as the church, but then he is the beginning, the firstborn, to use that word a second time, here not in his world, in the world of creation, but in the world of redemption. He's the firstborn from the dead. And here it's clear that what Paul's referring back to is the resurrection of Jesus. And even in that, you might be tempted to think, but I know the story of Jesus. Jesus is not the first person who died and came back to life. I mean, we know the story of Lazarus. Jesus is the one who did that while he was alive, before he died. There's a difference, though, in the resuscitation kind of work that Jesus did on Lazarus, a man he brought back to life who would then once again be claimed by death. Jesus' resurrection as the firstborn from the dead is in the ultimate victory over death that Jesus' resurrection signified. He's the one, as Paul would say in other spots, like the first little bit of a shoot of green that comes up out, indicating a harvest that's going to come later. Jesus' resurrection was much like that. His defeat of death is something that will never die. In fact, death dies in Jesus' resurrection, and therefore, in everything, he is going to be preeminent. Verses 19 and 20 spell out how that happened. In him, all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell. The word fullness, Michael would have us note, is actually all by itself. Commentators needed to add the words of God to be able to give us a little bit of an indication that of the way this word would work. But in the Greek, it would be more so to be able to say all the fullness was pleased to dwell. And through him then to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of his cross. And if we had more time, we could really preach a few sermons just on 19 and 20 by themselves, couldn't we? The reality is that when Jesus came to the earth, he was carrying all the fullness of the deity in himself. That's worthy of a sermon. But you might ask, why would God come to the earth except to come as a punishing conqueror? If you're a city who's been in rebellion against a long-distant king, and one day the king's son shows up at your doorstep, you've got to be thinking, we're in trouble. He has sent his emissary, he sent his son to come and punish us for our rebellion. And honestly, that's the way that the earth should feel at Christmas time, right? We have been in rebellion against our king long enough, and finally he sent his son. And when this one grows up, we know exactly what's going to happen to us. But John is so clear. God did not send his son into the world to condemn the world, but that through him we might be saved. And that's what Paul is pointing out. All the fullness of him was pleased to dwell so that this body that is made of flesh and blood could make peace as his blood is being poured out. Those are the nouns with one verb, reconcile. But that reconciliation is really what required the incarnation, isn't it? To be able to bring us back to God required one, not just who came from heaven, but who came and stood in our place. Jesus, who not just came to the gates of our city and kicked down the doors and said, I'm here, finally, but actually one who, so to speak, snuck in the back way and lived his life among the people of the city. And then took on the punishment that everyone in the city deserved. It was the only way we could be reconciled to God, and it was the way that Jesus chose. Those are the verses, Colossians 1, 15 through 20, primarily as we look at the nouns. But nouns kind of lose a little bit of their sing-song quality if you don't get into the rest of it, and this is where the rhythm comes through. First thing I want us to marvel at is that as the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation, created all things for himself. I find that point absolutely baffling. Because before we look at it, just recognize the number of times in your life that you don't buy into that. You have a job. You worked hard to get your job. You've earned things through your job and through your hard work. And somehow in the process of you preparing for your job and deploying yourself into your job and earning money out of your job, you began to think that that job belonged to you. And so you think that somehow everything about your work was created for you. Have you ever met parents who've done this with their kids? They longed for children. They prayed for children. They rejoiced when they had children. And then suddenly when those children didn't treat them with the respect that they thought they deserved, they got so angry and entitled. And something about this gift just turned toxic and began to kind of spoil on the vine. And you just thought, I don't think that this is what parenthood is supposed to be. The sense that you think that this created child has been created for you. Maybe you can't relate to those two examples, but I'll bet if we kick the tires on your life a little bit, that somewhere in the middle of it, entitlement starts to show its ugly head. We think that our comforts are for us. We think that our possessions are for us. And Paul reminds us, please stop. Please just stop and sing this song with me. As the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation, created all things for himself. So he says in verse 16, it's by him. It is only by him that all things were created. But he doesn't just stop on that preposition. He turns the dial up at the end of verse 16 and he says, it is not only by him all things were created, it is through him that all things were created. In other words, he wasn't sort of just signing the paperwork at creation and somehow saying, all right, well, here's the way this is going to go. We want to just make sure that creation goes this way. All right, I've signed the edict. Here's my executive order, so let it be written, so let it be done. And then creation just happened. No, he was so invested into the process of making everything visible and invisible. He was so invested into the process of making everything in heaven and on earth and setting up all the processes where anyone who's ever existed has ever been in power. All of that happened by him. And all of it happened through him, so that the only conclusion you can come to is that it happened for him. And that means that anyone who's ever been given any bit of power, any bit of authority. Anyone who could ever be said to be a ruler or to have any dominion. Anyone who could ever be said to hold sway over anyone else that's ever used that power for themselves has violated the basic tenets of this song. Because we've taken what Paul's singing over everything and we've started putting asterisks on little things. And say, this thing, this thing, this thing, it's for me. I'll keep it here. It's not his, it's mine. Some sort of terrible song that we sing when we possess our friends, when we possess our spouses, when we possess our kids, and we believe that what they're supposed to be doing is to make me comfortable, to make me respected. And we turn this song around and we forget it's by him. It's through him. It's for him. Unless we turn into deists, verse 17 would remind us, not only is he before all things, every single thing's ongoing existence is held together in him. By him, and through him, and for him, and in him. This is why in John we read, no one has ever seen God. But the only God who is at the Father's side, he's the one who's made him known. In other words, if Jesus never came, we'd have no idea what we were talking about when we were making our way through this world. Because we couldn't relate to who God was without Jesus being here. But lest we relate to him as though he's any teacher or any sort of other person, we read in Hebrews chapter 1, no, he is the radiance of the glory of God, the exact imprint of his nature. And then he uses the same exact conclusion. The one who made all this upholds all this. He upholds the universe by the word of his power. Now, the Adams aren't here today. And so, Catherine, I hope that this is going to qualify, but I did have a little bit of a conflict with Catherine Adams a couple weeks ago, and I understood her point. She said, you used to reference the Lord of the Rings all the time. And so in coming to this church, Noah decided he was going to have me walk through all of the Lord of the Rings movies. And so I have endured over 9 hours of cinematic brilliance, I would say. Your life is improved by this, Catherine. But the point she's made afterwards is you stopped referencing the Lord of the Rings. I did all this so I could fit in. And now you stopped. What's going on? Catherine, this is for you. You remember the moment, right? It's the Council of Elrond. The ring sits before those gathered from the Dwarven Kingdom and the Elven Kingdom and the kingdoms of men. They're all trying to figure out what to do about this one doom. And one man thinks they should use the ring. And another, a mere ranger called Strider, he speaks up to confront him and tells him, you can't wield it. No one can. And the first man, Boromir, looks at him and says, what would a mere ranger know about such things? And right? It's not this way in the books. In case you're that much of a Tolkien nerd, I get it. The movie's not like the book. But the movie sells better, so we're going to quote the movie. That's when the elf, Legolas, stands up and says, this is no mere ranger. He is Aragorn, son of Arathorn. You owe him your allegiance. And Boromir has to figure out what to do at that moment. He gets it at the end, when he gets it at the end. At the moment of his death, it makes sense to him. But at that moment, he rejects it. And he says, we don't need a king. You're not a king. He just turns his back on him entirely. Can you hear Paul like Legolas? Catherine, you getting it? Can you hear Paul doing that same thing? This is no mere carpenter. This is no mere teacher. He's no mere magician. He is the creator, son of the glorious king. You owe him everything. And the world has written this off. And it is begging you to come along with them. It is begging you to reject this song. We need no king. Exhibit A, every Disney movie ever. Your answers are inside you. Truth is inside you. The capacity to determine right and wrong is inside you. No one should be outside of you determining your reality. The essence of atheism, the essence of materialism, it all screams back against this song and says, Gondor has no king, Gondor needs no king. This earth is fine without Jesus. So we'll use his name, but not the way this song does. Why does our planet continue to exist in the face of this blasphemy? And why does the church sometimes reject Paul and follow the world in this as well? It's because our hearts want those little things that we've tucked away in our pockets and said, this belongs to me. My job, it belongs to me. My future, it belongs to me. This sum of money, it belongs to me. My reputation, it belongs to me. And if you would claim these things, God, I can't have it. I have no king. I need no king. And Paul would just say, by him, through him, for him, in him. You have no answer to these prepositional phrases. But it's not just creation that Paul would remind us about. And it's not just those prepositions. The second point that screams out of this song is that the head of the visible church, the firstborn from the dead, reconciled all things to himself. See, as the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation, created all things for himself, but then all those things tore themselves away from his rule. They all set themselves on a different trajectory from the gravity of his rule. And rather than letting us just spin out into our own chaos, he came to us. As the head of the visible church, the firstborn from the dead, then reconciled all things to himself. And so we come back to another prepositional phrase. It starts at verse 18. He's the head of the body, the church. He's the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, so that in everything he might be preeminent. Why? For, here's the next phrase, in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and then through him to reconcile himself. In other words, if the other prepositions of creation weren't enough, that Creator God invested all of his fullness into one man who could then be killed, so that he'd be preeminent. So that it wouldn't just be the triumphant lamb or the triumphant lion that was worshipped at the end, that it would be the slaughtered lamb who would be receiving praise. He possesses all of God's fullness in him so that all reconciliation could take place through him. And this is where we have to square up with the question of what do we do every time we screw up? Where does your soul go when it faces its own weakness and its own failure? What do you do? Do you seek some means of penance? trying to somehow tip the scale the other way, piece by piece by piece by piece, hoping that somehow that will move this 10-ton weight against you. As though in you was enough to reconcile yourself back to God. Or can we view his holiness as so far from us, the weight of our sin as so much greater than we can fathom, so that the only thing that could happen to tip the scale back and actually reconcile God back to smiling at us again would be if all of his fullness was poured into one man, and that man stood in our place. Paul says, sing that with me. But not when you just go out into creation, but you square up against the mud pit of your sin. When you have to think back to your failure, maybe from distant past, or maybe just from this morning, who will you turn to? And Paul says, turn to him. Sing to him. Come to this one. There's one other grammatical point that we want to catch out of all of this. And to do that, I think we have to look at the passage in all of its entirety. So here it is, verses 15 through 20, kind of in one text. There it is. Nothing particularly special. It's hard to read probably at that size. I get it. But look at it this way. I might have missed a couple because it was hard to catch them all because there's a lot of them in there. One of the major focuses of this song is how much it speaks in universal terms. Did you ever raise your kid not to talk in absolutes? He always, you never, I'm perfect, you're horrible, everything about me is great, everything about you is poopy, or just whatever you do, right? It's just a universal tone inside all of us, and wisdom is being able to say to a child, grow up into understanding this. You can never speak in absolutes. You can never use universal terms. Well, look at that, what we're doing, right? It's weird, we always want to gravitate towards it. And we always recognize the folly when we do. I want 100% of the time to have myself wearing the white hat, and I want 100% of the time to put the black hat on you. I want to use terms that make me look good and that make you look, you know, less than good. And wisdom usually means recognizing you're not as pure as you think and somebody's not as evil as they think. The situation is more complicated than you think. That's wisdom, right? Except for no. Paul, in an expression of the pure wisdom of God, uses absolute language all through this. All creation, all things, all things, all things, all things, everything, all things. He is just addicted to this kind of language to let us know there is not a moment, there is not a thing, there's not a location that escapes his authority. Because he's the firstborn from creation, and he's the firstborn from the dead. He's the one who made everything that rebelled from him, and he's the only way that anything made can be brought back to him. And if that's the case, then the question we've got to ask is, where do we stand in relationship to this one? This world will help you avoid that song. It will help you avoid that reality. You can scroll and amuse yourself to death. You can take your soul and you can comfort it into some state of anesthesia. But the reality is, every one of us have to square up with where we stand in relationship to this God. And the offer is this: we can be, to use the words of verse 20, at peace by the blood of his cross. Or to use the words that he gave to the Ephesians in kind of a parallel book to Colossians, you who were once far off have been brought near by the blood of Christ, for he himself is our peace. That's the good news this leaves us with. It's not just a song so that we could admire Jesus from a distance. It's a song that invites us to sing it with him in an embrace. If that's not your status, then the weird thing I have to tell you is that this meal we're going to take at the end of this isn't actually for you. Because the meal doesn't create anything. It's not what we believe about communion. We're going to take communion at the end of this time. If your relationship with Jesus is marked by faith, that he's the one who created you and he's the one who brought you back, then please come. Enjoy this meal together. But that's what we do when we come to this table, is remember it's by the body of Jesus and by the blood of Jesus that we who are far off have been brought close, so that we can sing this song with him forever.